You listen to the Real Sports Guys, where real guys talk real sports. Sponsored by Resistance Digital Solutions, resistancedigital.com, RSG.
But singing, we have a special guest tonight who is works for the Bible Boxing Ring magazine, which I read a lot growing up. He's the editor for RingTV.com. Does a lot of live fights and interviews. A number of the top fighters that you've all heard of, and is well connected in the game of boxing. And we're excited to welcome to the Sports Guys for the first time, Doug Fisher. How you doing, Doug?
Hey guys, I'm doing good.
Doug, welcome. We got a lot we want to talk to you, and I'm glad you can spend some time with us tonight talking about the fight game. I want to start, we just had this great fight that was action-packed between Khan and Amir Khan and Danny Garcia being devastating knockout. So I know you covered the fight. Can you tell us a little bit about your thoughts after watching that fight and covering it? Talk a little bit about that fight for folks who didn't have a chance to see the fight.
Well, it's a reminder. That fight was a reminder that, you know, anybody has a chance in boxing. And you can have a matchup in boxing where one fighter is a better athlete, has better technique, may have better skills, has more experience, might have more poise in big event atmosphere, but he can still lose to somebody who catches him clean on the jaw. In any other sport, if you have somebody who has all those advantages, you know, let's say tennis, if two guys are playing tennis, we can all safely put our money on the tennis player who has more experience, has better technique, is bigger, stronger, quicker, faster, all those things. We can bet on he's going to beat the guy who doesn't have the edge in those categories. But since they're not playing tennis, since they're hitting each other, since they're throwing punches at each other's jaw, and in fact the punch that really turned the fight was a shot that basically landed on Amir Khan's neck, kind of landed on his ear and his neck, kind of towards the brainstem, and just discombobulated him. And I'll tell you what, being there live, it's we see knockouts in boxing, but usually when a knockout occurs, the guy who gets knocked down or knocked out from a single punch, he was getting beat up. But one of the great things about boxing is it can be somebody who was a huge favorite coming in, as Khan was, and has a lot of advantages and is showing all of those advantages for rounds. You know, for two rounds, Amir Khan looked like he was in a higher class than Danny Garcia. And he was considered an elite fighter, whereas Danny Garcia had just sort of stepped onto the world-class category in boxing. And it looked like there was a solid level between them. And then with one punch, though, the guy who was winning is suddenly out on his feet. He's knocked down. He gets up. His legs aren't under him. There's still some seconds in the round. You're not even sure if he's going to survive the round. But then another great thing about boxing is that these guys have so much heart. Even when you think the guy who is all but knocked out doesn't stand a chance, he can come out for the next round the way Amir Khan did and almost turn things around. Amir Khan, for 2 minutes and 20 seconds, I'll say, in the fourth round, survived on really just heart and guile. He doesn't have great defensive technique or defensive instincts. He's kind of like that moth who's attracted to the flame. The guy had no legs even coming out for the fourth round after a one-minute rest. But he was still throwing punches back at Danny Garcia and blocking punches and eating punches and getting hurt and getting wobbled, but he was coming back and nailing Garcia with punches. And so I would say for 2 minutes and 20 seconds in that fourth round, it was, to me, it was as good as boxing gets, because there was just so much excitement and so much drama, because we just didn't know what was going to happen. We thought we knew what was going to happen going into the fight. Amir Khan would be too much for Danny Garcia. And then Danny Garcia flips the script with one huge left hook at the end of the third round. And in the fourth round, we're not quite sure what to expect, because we're seeing Danny Garcia miss punches, get caught with punches, And ringside, people are saying, you know what? If Amir Khan makes it out of this round, he might turn things around. He might regain control of this fight. Maybe Danny Garcia punches himself out. Maybe in trying to go for the knockout in this round, Danny Garcia is going to run into a huge shot. So when you have that kind of drama going on, it's just, it's to me, it's the most compelling sport in the world. And, of course, Danny clipped him again and put him down, you know, like the final 40 seconds of the fourth round, and won a huge upset. If you had bet Danny Garcia to win by KO, you would have, at the Mandalay Bay in Las Vegas where the fight took place, you could have gotten 8-1 odds. So, I mean, that the result of that fight was a result that odds makers did not think was going to happen. But odds makers don't know. Guys like me who have been covering boxing for more than 15 years, we can't call it. And that's the great thing about the sport when we have upsets. I think upsets add as much excitement to the sport as bad decisions seem to suck away the love for boxing.
You listen to The Real Sports Guys. We're on with Duck Fisher, editor with RingTV.com, and a well-versed, well-connected in the sport of boxing, and we're glad to have him here on The Real Sports Guys. When we think about Khan, I mean, the way he fought is also, and Max Kellerman talked a little bit about this, displays how he's approached the sport with heart. You know, he had the loss to Lamont Peterson. Lamont test for enhancing drugs for a test that he wanted everybody to take, and then he failed.
And then
he has to then fight Garcia. He's looking for the next best opponent, so he's never ducking. And then he gets in this fight and he loses. What does this mean? We've seen people come back before. Lennox Lewis, other folks with devastating losses. What do you think about Khan and his ability to rebound?
Well, here's something you got to remember about Amir Khan. As accomplished as he is, and he was a silver medalist in the 2004 Olympics, he's won two major titles at junior welterweight, and he's fought a lot of fighters who were former champions like Zab Judah and Pauly Malignaggi and really most of the top contenders in his weight class. He's only 25 years old, and he was 17 years old when he was winning that silver medal in the I think it was the Athens Games. And so despite his accomplishments, he's still young, and he can still learn. I mean, he's never going to have a great chin, but that doesn't mean that he cannot be a champion. It doesn't mean that he certainly doesn't mean that he can't be a compelling fighter. Just the opposite. Fighters who are offensive-minded and are risk-takers, the way Khan is. He takes a risk in the opponents he chooses to fight, and he takes risks in the manner in which he fights in the ring, because with his height and his reach and his speed is crazy. He could box safety first, and it would be hard for punchers like Danny Garcia to land that shot. But he gives them opportunities because, you know, let's face it, he gets a little bit greedy in there. You know, he could have just stuck Danny Garcia with a jab for four, five, or six rounds, and Garcia's face would have been a mess. I mean, Garcia's face was a mess after 12 rounds with Eric Morales in March of this year. Mm-hmm. And Eric Morales is older than dirt in boxing terms. He's, you know, a very famous, a great fighter, a great Mexican legend, but he didn't have it anymore. He didn't have reflexes. He didn't have the athleticism anymore, and he was fighting way over his natural weight class. And yet, he still busted up Danny Garcia just with one punch, the left jab. Now think of what Amir Khan could have done with his left jab if he would have just committed to it and showed some professional patience, but he doesn't have that. But because of that, he's a compelling fighter. What he needs to learn, really, since he can't do anything to make that chin better, is how to stick to a game plan a little bit, because even with the Lamont Peterson fight, he didn't really stick to the game plan that his coach, a Hall of Famer, Freddie Roach, had laid out for him. He stayed in the pocket, which means he stayed in close with Lamont Peterson, allowed himself to be maneuvered to the ropes, and then he and Peterson just went toe-to-toe. And it made for a good fight, but Peterson is a tenacious technician and, you know, just by nature a busier fighter, and Peterson was able to outwork Amir Khan in a lot of rounds. And he won a very close, split decision. Khan could have won the Peterson fight had he been a little bit more mobile. And I believe, you know, as most people thought going into the fight, that he could have been too much for Danny Garcia if he would have used his height and his reach and his speed advantage and boxed on the outside. But he was coming forward, and he was putting three- and four-punch combinations. And in trying to put that hurt on Danny Garcia put that hurt on Amir Khan. But he's young. He's 25, so he can come back. You just pointed out Lennox Lewis. Lennox Lewis got knocked out in just two rounds by a guy named Oliver McCall, who was viewed at the time as a journeyman. He wasn't even considered a real contender. And then Lennox Lewis was knocked out by Hasim Rockman. That was a huge upset.
Yep.
And he came back, and he knocked out Rockman and, you know, won the rest of his fights. He's retired, and he was just inducted into the International Boxing Hall of Fame just last year. And some people consider Lennox Lewis to be a great heavyweight. Vladimir Klitschko is another example. He's the heavyweight champion of the world. Some people think no one can beat him. Some folks are talking now, you know, Klitschko's won his last 15 or 16 bouts. Some people are talking now, well, how would have Vladimir Klitschko fared with Muhammad Ali or Joe Louis or whatever? They're starting to compare him with the greatest of all time. And this is a guy who was knocked out by Lehman Brewster in much the same fashion that Amir Khan was knocked out by Danny Garcia. It was a fight that he was winning against a guy who wasn't as fast, maybe not as technically clean as he was, but a guy who could take a shot and who could deliver a shot. And Brewster turned that fight around in one round, knocked out Vladimir Klitschko in the fifth round of a very dramatic fight in the very same venue, Mandalay Bay in Las Vegas. And that fight was also televised on HBO. And that was in 2004. But since that point, Vladimir Klitschko has changed his game. He's not quite as offensive-minded. He's stunk it out a few nights when he's had to. He's made certain tactical and technical changes in the ring where he's, you know, relying more on his jab, he's moving more, he's tying guys up on the inside, leaning on them, doing a lot of stuff that his Hall of Fame trainer, Emmanuel Stewart, has taught him. Now, Khan has a Hall of Fame trainer in Freddie Roach. All he needs to do is listen to him. That's what Vladimir Klitschko started doing after he got knocked out by Lehman Brewster. Started listening to the sage that is in his corner and in his training camps, and now people are talking about Vladimir Klitschko as being a Hall of Famer. So, yeah, absolutely. Other fighters have done it. Fighters who may not be as talented as Amir Khan have turned it around after not just one, but two devastating KO losses.
When you talk about trainer, no one is more braggadocious than Angel Garcia and Danny Garcia's father.
Yeah,
which probably
the
motivated.
Father's pride. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, motivated a little bit. When you think about Danny Garcia, I mean, he doesn't. There's no flash. He gives you that Philly toughness.
Yeah.
Right. He's in there. He's got that workmanlike approach to his game, and you're talking about someone who sticks to his game plan. He obviously stuck to his game plan and stayed patient. Where do you see him going? Where's his ceiling? Where do you see him going?
You know what? I think with a couple of fights, people will begin to regard Danny Garcia as the same way they regarded Amir Khan coming into this past Saturday's fight as an elite 140-pounder, as the real junior welterweight champ. And I will say Ring Magazine recognizes Danny Garcia as the 140-pound champion of the world. So does the WBC and the WBA. So he's got a lot of recognition right now as being the champ of his division. But the great thing about Garcia is he's young. He's just 24. And he doesn't have a lot of wear and tear. Yeah, that was his 24th fight. And there are dance partners in that division. That 140-pound division is deep, and it's talented. And there's guys like Zab Judah who would make for an attractive fight on the East Coast, because Zab Judah's from Brooklyn and he lives in New Jersey, and Danny Garcia is from Philadelphia, and there's a lot of diehard fans from those regions. So that would be a big fight in Philadelphia or New York City or Atlantic City. Beyond Judah, you got Bombers. You got these Latin guys from South America like Marcos Maidana and Lucas Matisse, who's just a beast. Matisse fought Zab Judah and almost beat him. A lot of people thought he did deserve a decision over Zab Judah. And he also lost a controversial decision to Devon Alexander out of St. Louis, a really talented fighter. And he's coming off a really good knockout of like a three-division Mexican champ named Humberto Soto. So Matisse is a guy. He's promoted by Golden Boy Promotions, just like Garcia is. So that's a fight that can be made in the division. And hardcore fans would be really into seeing that fight because Garcia is a quick-fisted, heavy-handed counterpuncher. And Matisse is one of these guys who stalks forward, throws a lot of punches, and he's got knockout power in both hands. So it's those kind of fights that the networks are going to want to buy, HBO and Showtime, and these are like even money fights, you know. Even though Zab Judah has been around forever, he's not really that old. He's still in his early 30s, and but he has that experience, and he's got speed, and he's got power. So that's like an even money fight, you know. So if Garcia were to beat a Zab Judah or to beat somebody like this guy from Argentina, Lucas Matisse, it'll be a good fight. It'll be a television fight. And if Garcia wins these fights, he's proving himself even more and more. Because there's still a lot of people that say, well, Garcia landed a lucky punch. I don't believe in that. I think there's no such thing as luck in sports and life and boxing. It's being in the right place at the right time. He was offered this opportunity. He stepped in to, you know, to replace Lamont Peterson against Amir Khan, and he made the most of his opportunity. So I give Danny Garcia all the credit. But there's still some people who say, well, you know what, Khan didn't have a good chin. So, okay, let's put Danny Garcia in there with somebody who we know has a good chin. This guy, Lucas Matisse, has never been dropped, never been knocked out. I've never seen him hurt in a fight. And he's got, like, the highest KO percentage in the division. You beat a guy like Matisse, people are going to start believing in you. And then, you know what? At that point, he's going to be on TV more often. And his dad, as crazy as his dad is and the inflammatory things his dad says, he makes for compelling TV. He certainly makes for compelling press events. I mean, this guy at a press conference, he's off the hook. It's crazy. You know, so one day if Danny Garcia can get to the point where he's going to fight somebody with a real big name, can you imagine a 24/7 with this guy? I mean, really, Angel Garcia puts Roger Mayweather and Floyd Mayweather Sr. to shame because he talks smack crazy. But it's okay. I mean, he's actually both Garcias. I know they're nice guys. I mean, the dad starts flying off the handle because he has so much belief in his son and he has so much pride in his son. He wants the world to know it, and he wants the world to know that his son is special. And who knows if his son really makes strides to gain sort of universal recognition as one of the top fighters. Maybe the dad will mellow out just a little bit. But that chip on his shoulder, it makes him interesting, and it helps make Danny interesting because Danny's a very soft-spoken, shy kind of guy.
You're on with the Real Sports Guys. We're on with Doug Fisher with RingTV.com, part of the Ring Magazine suite of media that's offered out there. It's the Bible of boxing. Like I said before, I grew up reading Ring and really enjoy that. It's really being the authority in boxing, and glad to have him here tonight. You talked about earlier what makes boxing compelling is these kind of fights, but then what draws it down are these decisions. Bradley Pacquiao fight left a bad taste. I was getting text messages. I was getting all kinds of craziness. And I score fights, and for some reason,
right,
I was going to try and take delay, and I couldn't even wait. People were texting me about this fight, talking about why they don't like boxing and all this stuff.
Yeah, now it hurt. That decision
you're
especially in
fight.
This age.
Talk about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk about that fight
in the age
and what
media.
You think people can say.
Yeah, when there's an outrageous decision or action that happens in the ring, it's reported on, quote unquote, instantly by, you know, potentially millions of people because of Twitter and other social media networks. People, it's not just the media that's reacting; it's everybody who's watching the fight. It's people in the industry, it's fans, it's folks who didn't even see it, aren't even watching it. They hear about it and like, what? Pacquiao lost a decision to Bradley. What? You know, I'll say this. I was ringside for it. I was shocked, okay? I didn't think that it was the worst robbery ever, even though I scored the fight 117 to 111 for Manny Pacquiao, which means I scored 9 out of the 12 rounds for Manny Pacquiao. There were close rounds. I tend to score a close round for the guy who's coming forward and trying to make the fight because I'm thinking – this guy who's kind of moving around, yeah, he's throwing little pitter-pat punches. He felt something, and he doesn't want to engage anymore. And I also feel that when you're challenging a guy who's not just the champion, but he's also, you know, like a legendary fighter, and you're the young up-and-comer who doesn't have a name, who who says he wants to make a name for himself and says he's going to do A, B, and C, I want you to follow through with that in the ring. I want you to act like you want it. I don't want you to try to run out the clock and just try to steal rounds or anything like that. I want you to fight. I want to see a fight when I go to a professional championship boxing match. I want to see prize fighting. I don't want to see amateur type, you know, let me just try to rack up points and land and get out of the way and all that. I mean, that is boxing, but the fact of the matter is Pacquiao was throwing a lot of punches, and he threw more punches, and he landed more punches. He landed more power punches. And professional boxing, to me, is that power. If you land a punch that hurts somebody or makes somebody make a decision to where, okay, I can't be in this, I got to get out of the kitchen because it's too hot, I'm going to score that round. If it's a close round, if it's a competitive round, I'm going to score to the fighter who's bringing the heat. And the fighter who can't take the heat, guess what? You lose that round. So having said that, there were close rounds. When I score a fight, I'll make a little note. This round's close. I'm scoring it for Pacquiao, but this round's close. It could have gone to the other guy. So there were rounds that I scored for Pacquiao. At least two rounds I thought could have gone to Bradley. It could have been I think no matter what Pacquiao won, you could make an argument that it was Pacquiao just won by a few points. I think the big shock was that a fighter who's super popular, who makes a lot of money, didn't get the benefit of the doubt. That was what was shocking. It wasn't the worst. I've seen horrible, horrible scorecards. Just in recent months, as a matter of fact, just this year, as a matter of fact, that were worse than Pacquiao Bradley. But what was bad about Pacquiao Bradley is Pacquiao Bradley was a huge pay-per-view event. It was a Manny Pacquiao fight. There was a lot of attention on it. And it was just shocking, just because the star got the crap end of the stick in a fight that most people, and when I say most people, I'm talking like 95% of the people watching it, whether they were media fans or, you know, boxing industry type people, they thought Pacquiao won the fight. Sometimes you got a controversial decision where people watching on TV think one guy won, like the rematch between Oscar De La Hoya and Shane Mosley. But you talk to Press Row, like 80% of Press Row thought Mosley legitimately won that rematch with Oscar De La Hoya. This wasn't the case. People watching at home thought Bradley lost. The media thought that Bradley lost. The people in the arena thought Bradley lost. Most people were in agreement Bradley lost, and yet he still wins. So that drives people crazy, and it makes them think that something's funny, that something is rotten in the fight game.
Well, I looked at it because I scored it. I feel like I'm moving towards it because I've been scoring this year, and I had that 117, 113 pack. Yeah. So when I heard your card, I'm thinking, okay, I was watching the fight the right way. Before I hand it to Phil, a little bit about scoring for people who don't know about scoring. Talk about the dimensions of scoring because you talked a little about bringing the pain, but there's ring generalship, there's effective aggression. Talk a little bit about for people so they can understand some of the differences that you do when you score a fight. Then Phil will come in and ask a question.
Yeah, effective aggression means you're making the fight, you're coming forward, you're throwing punches, and you're landing punches. Ineffective aggression, you're coming forward, you're throwing punches, and the other guy's blocking or making you miss. You're not landing punches. Beyond aggression and clean punches is paramount. That's what wins rounds. That's what wins fights. That's how you rack up points in the professional game. Beyond that, there's defense and there's ring generalship. Defense is pretty clear. You're making the other guy miss. Ring generalship is a little bit harder to define. I define ring generalship as controlling about without putting hands on your opponent. Guys like Bernard Hopkins are great ring generals because they don't throw a lot of punches, and they're not always aggressive for 3 minutes of a round, but they still control the fight. They control the tempo. They control the distance the fight is fought from. They control the pace and tempo of the fight. And from the first round to the 12th round, they generally figure out a way to neutralize their opponent and often wear that opponent down and win. And that, and they're doing it with, you know, with their experience and their guile, and that's ring generalship. But the number one criteria for winning a round of professional boxing is landing clean punches. Beyond that, it's the effective aggression. Beyond that, it's defense. And then, you know, if two fighters are equal in terms of clean punching and their defensive prowess and their aggression, then you go to ring generalship. Then you start to look at the nuances like, okay, who's controlling the distance? Who's imposing whose style on the other guy? If you can hear that little voice, that's my four-year-old. Yes, sweetie, but you have to ask your sister to help you out with that. Yeah. Sorry about that, guys. Yeah, they were at the neighbor's house, but that wasn't going to last. So go on.
You're listening to The Real Sports Guys on realsportsguys.com, where we're thrilled here to have Doug Fisher, the editor of Ring TV, as well as the associate editor of The Ring Magazine, the Bible of Boxing. Now, Doug, a lot of fans like myself get really frustrated with boxing. I love watching boxing, but then I ask myself reasonable questions like, why hasn't Mayweather and Pacquiao fought? You know, what's up with this scoring where there's so much subjectivity to it? Doug, talk about how a lot of boxing fans have left and went to UFC and what boxing needs to do to kind of get that fan base back.
Well, one thing that the UFC does that boxing doesn't do, and the advantage that the UFC has, which is the advantage that, you know, the major team sports in boxing have over boxing, is that there's a central authority. There's they have a market strategy, and they have all of the talent basically signed up, so they can put the best teams or the best fighters in with each other, because that's what fans of any sport want. They want to see the best against the best. They want to see some kind of progression where these guys prove themselves as contenders, they prove themselves as champions, and when they've reached that pinnacle, that top level, particularly in a combat sport, and the two best happen to reside in the same division as Mayweather and Pacquiao do, they want to see those guys fight. And that's the way boxing used to be. You know, when there's a Roberto Duran coming up to welterweight, he had to fight Sugar Ray Leonard. And when he beat Leonard, they had to do it again. And when Leonard proved himself against Duran, and there's Tommy Hearns, they had to fight each other. The best would fight each other. And that's what people expect. It hasn't happened in recent decades because boxing has always been fractured. It's not centrally regulated, okay? As far as its rules and regulations, that's regulated by state commissions. So it changes state by state, and some commissions are stronger than other commissions. And there's also more than one championship. There's the WBC and the WBA and the IBF and the WBO, and even Ring Magazine, you know, recognizes champions. So there's that kind of dissension. The sport can still work despite all that confusion and despite that lack of a unified regulation when the promoters and the managers work together. And there was a time when they didn't always work together, but when they needed to work together, they did. You know, Don King and Bob Arum, who's the CEO of Top Rank Promotions, they didn't see eye to eye. They you know, in the 80s and the 90s, they were the two biggest promoters. But when it came down to it, when there was enough money to be made, they would go ahead and make the fight that the public wanted, and everybody made money, such as when Oscar De La Hoya fought Felix Trinidad, when they were both undefeated welterweights in 1999. But it's gotten to the point now where it's not just fractured, where the different promoters have their own interests, but they just can't work together. I mean, the quick answer to the reason Mayweather and Pacquiao have not been in the ring yet and probably never will is because there's too many – the egos that are involved, there's just not enough respect between the parties. There's too much venom between Oscar De La Hoya, who used to fight for Bob Arum, Floyd Mayweather, who also used to fight for Arum. They left Arum to make their own name, and they've made their names. And, you know, they have their issues with Bob, and Bob has their issues with them. And Bob has his issues with Richard Schaefer, the CEO of Golden Boy Promotions, and with Al Haymon, the manager of Floyd Mayweather. And these guys that I've mentioned, they're all multimillionaires, you know. Pacquiao as well. Freddie Roach, shoot, he's got an ego. You know, all these guys have their egos. They have a lot of money. And, you know, I always say boxing is money motivated. That's why, you know, these hungry young fighters from all around the world become prize fighters to get that prize. But it's ego-driven. And it's not just the egos of the fighters that determine what fights are made. It's the egos of the managers, of the network executives, and of course, the promoters. You know, we can't have these fights don't happen without the promoters. And if the promoters don't get along, then the best fights in the sport don't happen, and the sport, it still thrives. It still continues. And when it's good, like we had with Garcia versus Khan, it's great. There's few things, few professional sports that are as compelling and dramatic and exciting, but it's not going to make new fans. I mean, the great thing about the UFC is the fights that the fans want to see are happening, and the UFC is, they market themselves to a new generation. And boxing really doesn't do that. They don't really market themselves to the young viewers and new demographics. They kind of just do things the way they normally do. In some ways, I think UFC has been healthy competition because of the way the high production value, the way they present the fights on TV and the live experience. I think, you know, boxing has sort of stepped up, you know, beefed up their undercards to pay-per-views to kind of match the UFC, and they weren't doing that for a long time. And they've made the in-the-arena experience a little more entertaining than they were for many years, and I think it's because of the success of the UFC. I think really the harshest competition that boxing faces is with itself. It cannibalizes itself. For lack of a better word, boxing eats itself. It could be really, really popular. It is popular in certain areas. And I'll give you a great example. September 15th falls on Mexican Independence Day, which has typically been a weekend where the top promoters have put on a big pay-per-view show that's headlined by like a popular Mexican fighter like Julio Cesar Chavez or Oscar De La Hoya back when he was with Bob Arum. And both Top Rank and Golden Boy Promotions wanted to use that date for a pay-per-view extravaganza. Golden Boy Promotions has a Mexican star named Saul Canelo Alvarez. He's the redheaded guy. He's undefeated. Mm-hmm. He's a junior middleweight title holder. You've probably seen him on HBO. He last fought Shane Mosley on the undercard of the Mayweather-Cotto pay-per-view. And he's pretty good. And he's like 21, 22 years old. He's still learning. But he's very popular in Mexico. So they're like, okay, he's going to be our guy to go on to fight on September 15th in a big pay-per-view. But at the same time, Bob Arum, with Top Rank, Golden Boy's rival, they've got the son of the Mexican legend, Julio Cesar Chavez Jr., and they're going to have him fight, you know, the guy Ring Magazine recognizes as the middleweight champ, Sergio Martinez. That's a huge fight. But they're both going on the same date, and they're actually holding the cards in the same city, Las Vegas. And neither one wants to back off from that date. Now, I'll tell you this is, and I mean this. Chavez versus Martinez is going to take place at the Thomas and Mack Center. That holds almost 19,000. I bet you they sell out. I bet you they get Mexican fans and hardcore fans and maybe even Martinez fans fill up, the Thomas and Mack Center. And, you know, just down the street at the MGM Grand, that's where Golden Boy's having the Saul Alvarez fight. Now, Alvarez is fighting a guy who just upset Victor Ortiz, a guy named Josecito Lopez, an iron chin brawler, but a guy who's coming up from junior welterweight. He should be fighting guys like Amir Khan and Danny Garcia. He shouldn't be fighting a big, strong junior middleweight like Saul Alvarez. But he's going to bring the fight. He's going to bring the noise. And I guarantee you, they have at least 10,000 because Saul Alvarez has drawn more than 10,000 in Los Angeles fighting nobodies, guys that nobody in this area have ever heard of. But he's got that kind of loyal fan base. So I wouldn't doubt if they get 15,000 in the MGM Grand at the same time that there's 18,000, 19,000 crammed in the Thomas and Mack Center. And I think Showtime, which is going to televise the Alvarez fight, is going to do good ratings. And I think the Chavez-Martinez fight is going to be a healthy pay-per-view. So that tells you something. There are enough people out there who love boxing to plunk down money for tickets and pay-per-view buys or to subscribe to Showtime to watch it. There's enough fans for boxing to support two cards taking place on the same day in the same city. But it begs the question, what if these promoters work together? What if Arum and Schaefer and Oscar De La Hoya could actually sit down in a room and say, hey, let's do a super card. Let's do a card that we could hold in a stadium. Let's have, you know, a headliner with Chavez and Martinez, and the co-feature is Saul Alvarez, and we put our undercards together, and we put together a boxing event that's bigger than anything the UFC has ever done. It could happen if they could just work together. So when people say, well, is UFC competing with boxing? Yeah, but so is football, basketball, so are the movies, so are the Avenger movie, the Dark Knight movie, whatever, you know. So it's everything's competing for boxing viewers. But nothing competes against boxing the way boxing does itself. Boxing competes against itself, and in doing so, it limits the growth of its audience. There's an audience there to sustain boxing, but there could be a much bigger audience if the promoters and the managers and the networks could work together. It could be huge. We could be talking about, you know, at least, you know, three or four times a year events that could fill Cowboy Stadium, you know, in Dallas. You know, you could have, talking about events that can be as big as the NBA All-Star game, you know what I mean? 80,000, 90,000. If boxing pulled its resources and worked together. And that's probably the most frustrating thing as a hardcore fan and somebody who covers the sport, is that the people who are running the sport and who are putting on the fights don't like each other, and they fight against each other, and they put fans and they put the media in this position where they got to choose. See, as somebody who covers the sport, I got to choose. Like, oh, well, which fight am I going to be at? Am I going to be at Chavez Martinez at Thomas and Mack, or am I going to be at Alvarez Lopez at the MGM Grand? We're splitting our audience, and we even divide the media that covers the sport. You're dividing the media, the people that gets the word out? You know, it's not smart.
You listen to The Real Sports Guys on realsportsguys.com. We've been talking to Doug Fisher. We got a few more minutes with him. Doug Fisher is at ringtv.com. He's the editor there. Just a sidebar to our listeners out there, check out the video section of this website. Doug and Rosenthal.
We got a good video
section, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed the video work you guys have done there.
Thank you.
Doug, let me ask you, talk about some of the hotbeds in boxing, internationally and domestically, where you're seeing some really good boxers kind of up and coming through the ranks that are making some noise.
Oh, well, internationally speaking, the UK, you know, Britain and, you know, the British Isles, Ireland, Scotland, Wales, all those areas that make up the United Kingdom, they have terrific fight fans who love the sport, love the history of the sport, and they come out to support it. I mean, there was a heavyweight fight that was looked at as sort of a rogue heavyweight fight just this past Saturday between David Hay and Derek Chisora. And these guys are not well known, you know, here in America, but they had 30,000 people turn out for this fight. And that was a fight between two heavyweights who weren't even licensed by the British Boxing Board of Control. It's kind of a rogue fight, and it was panned and banned by a lot of the boxing media, British boxing media. But it was still a tremendous success financially, and it was a good fight, too. David Hay won by an entertaining fifth or sixth round knockout. Beyond the UK, there's Germany, where boxing is a network sport, and the ratings compare with any other sport. There's Japan, where boxing is a network sport, and the ratings that boxing get are equal to, and in many cases higher, than mixed martial arts, which is huge over in Japan. Or pro wrestling, which is huge in Japan. Mexico, of course, boxing's like a religion over there. Same thing with Puerto Rico. And here in the United States, there's the old fight towns that still have just so many fans, like New York, Chicago. If you watched Friday Night Fights this past Friday, there was a show from Chicago that was headlined by former light heavyweight champ Glenn Johnson fighting a kid who was born in Poland but has been living and training in Chicago, and he was been embraced and sort of adopted by the Polish community in Chicago. And that was a really good Friday Night Fight. It's probably one of the better broadcasts. And the young up-and-comer from Poland, his last name is Fanfara, Andrew Fanfara, he actually won. He beat Glenn Johnson in a really entertaining light heavyweight fight. And Chicago's great because it's basically the ethnic demographics. It's Mexico, Puerto Rico, African-American, Caucasian-American, Polish, Russian, all these communities are all right there in that metro area. And those are all, traditional groups that love boxing. Of course, where I am in Los Angeles, is an old fight town, and it's always been a hotbed for boxing because a lot of the world-class fighters train here. You know, they wherever they fight in the world or wherever they're from, they come here and they train. And there's just also a lot of, really good homegrown talent that has come out of the Southern California area, decade after decade. And the guys that were young when I first started covering the sport went on to become some of the biggest stars, guys like Shane Mosley and Oscar De La Hoya and Fernando Vargas from Oxnard. These guys went on to become world beaters, and that makes for a lot of diehard fans in this area. Texas is huge, too. It's got that great, the Mexican population's there, but there's just like a lot of hardcore fans in every major city in Texas, whether it's Dallas, Fort Worth area, Houston, it's boxing is huge. El Paso, it's huge. San Antonio, even Austin. So these are the areas. I left out Canada, Quebec, where folks are speaking French or whatever. It's a huge sports area. They love sports. Obviously, they love hockey. That's like a religion out there. But boxing's huge. They come out and support talent that may not have been born in Canada, because there's a lot of immigrants from Haiti and a lot of folks who are from where are they from? There's Polish. I'm trying to think of the one of those Eastern European nations for some reason. Oh, Romania. I don't know why. They get a bunch of talent from Romania. But those guys get adopted. They learn, as long as they learn French, the folks are going to they're gonna back them. And they can fight anybody. And they're doing like 15,000 people, 20,000 people. And, for fights that are really kind of like ESPN level here, but they're just huge events there. So, I mean, boxing's very popular. Throughout the country and around the world. And I just wish that in America it was a little more organized the way it is in Germany and in Japan and to a slightly lesser extent in the United Kingdom. Because part of the reason boxing is popular in those areas is because the promoters work together and the commissions that regulate boxing seem to be more organized than the state-by-state commissions here in the United States.
Now, before I toss it back to Devon, let me ask you, Doug, you touched on the spot there, all these different commissions and entitlement bodies. Do you think that helps boxing or hurts boxing?
I think ultimately it hurts boxing. I think there needs to be uniform standards, okay? When I say standards for the matchups that are made, I don't think we should see a guy who's 30-0 with 25 knockouts fight a guy with 5 wins and 15 losses and no knockouts who happens to be like 45 years old. We don't need to see that. We know what's going to happen, and we don't want to see anybody get hurt. So we need to have uniform standards in every U.S. jurisdiction that says, okay, yeah, we understand, you got a prospect, you want to build them up, you don't want them to lose, but that doesn't mean you find some vagrant and put trunks and boxing gloves on them and toss them into the ring to get beat up. That's not a sport. That's wrong. But we also need standards for the commissioners and the officials, the referees, and the judges. I mean, when we're talking about world-class boxing, we need to make sure that there are world-class referees and world-class judges who are officiating the bout. Because beyond the safety of the fighter, there's just the fighter's career. A lot of fighters get their careers knocked off track because of a bad call of a referee who wasn't really good enough to be in there with those fighters. He wasn't good enough. He's like a four-round or six-round level referee refereeing a 10-round or 12-round bout. That's no good. So we need to have uniform standards in every state, and I think a national commission is the way to do that. We need to have you've got to get out of the good old boy network of the commissions, because when you're talking about just state by state, you get cronyism, and you get this sort of this mentality where the officiating isn't about finding the best officials for the best fights, you know what I mean, finding the right guys or women for the right job. It's about rotation. Okay, everybody's got to get their turn. Everybody who's in our little pool of referees, you know, whether they're 80 years old or whether they just started a year ago, they got to get their chance on this televised card or whatever. That's no good. No, the referees and the judges need to be selected on their merit. I don't want to see a rotation for the sake of rotation. I just want to see the best. I don't care if Kenny Bayless has to be the referee for every major fight in Nevada. You know what? Kenny Bayless is really good. Usually, I don't see a lot of controversy when Kenny Bayless is a referee. I want him. I don't want to see referees that are getting kind of long in the tooth and getting forgetful in there and not paying attention. You know, Joe Cortez, he says he's fair and firm. Sometimes he is, sometimes he ain't. And it's not because he's not trying. He's just getting long in the tooth. He's just getting old. And these guys, like, listen, the guy, I think his name is Jerry Ford. He made a lot of boxing fans angry because he's like, oh, well, I thought Tim Bradley, whatever, I forgot his words, that, you know, he put on a boxing clinic or took Manny to school or whatever.
Right.
Jerry Ford has been around since the 70s. Jerry Ford was one of the judges for Marvin Hagler versus Vito Antuofermo. You go and ask any boxing fan now, they don't even remember who Vito Antuofermo was. That fight took place in 1980, okay? That's like, dude, you've had your time. You had the 80s, 90s, and the 2000s, man. Why are you still here? I mean, there needs to be new blood, and I think that's part of what a commission should do. When I talk about a national commission, I'm not talking about like a regulating authority that makes the fights or forces people to do this or that, because you can't force promoters to work together, and you can't force fighters to get in the ring, but we should at least have uniform standards, rules, and regulations for the safety of the fighter, and just for the benefit of the fight of the fight game, the benefit of the fans. Because like we all know, nothing turns fans off more than bad decision and poor officiating.
Well, we're on with Doug Fisher, editor with Ring TV, part of the Ring magazine. This suite of this the Bible of boxing and. Everything you need to know, check out Ring Magazine, and it'll keep you up on your boxing. Doug, before we let you go, can you talk a little bit about a few fights that you're going to be covering come up here that the listeners should be paying attention to?
Let me think. What do I have coming up? I just got back from Vegas. I was going to cover the fight in San Jose. It's on July 28th. That's going to be on Showtime. It's Robert Guerrero, who's really kind of like a career junior lightweight and lightweight, moving up to all the way to welterweight to fight some undefeated guy from Turkey named Selçuk Aydın. But I'm not gonna cover that fight. I'll watch it on Showtime, and I'll be watching with interest for that fight. I think the next big fight that I cover is going to be September 8th. It's going to be in Oakland, and that's going to be Andre Ward, the undefeated Ring Magazine super middleweight champion, against Chad Dawson, the light heavyweight champion. He just beat Bernard Hopkins. Just has one loss. A very talented southpaw boxer, can punch a little bit. And he's actually stepping down from light heavyweight, that's 175 pounds, to 168 pounds, to challenge Andre Ward for his super middleweight titles. And that's a fight for the purists, because Andre Ward is like a young Bernard Hopkins. He's got that ring generalship. He finds a way to neutralize everybody. He finds ways to shut guys down. And Dawson is just immensely talented, athletically speaking, and in terms of his skills, his skill set. And he's a busy southpaw. So it's going to be kind of interesting how these two tremendous athletes and very intelligent boxers kind of go in there to try to shut each other down. And I think it's the first time a ring-recognized champion fought another ring-recognized champion. And, you know, Andre Ward is somebody who is ranked pretty high in most pound-for-pound lists. I think he's, like, number five in the Ring Magazine's pound-for-pound.
Yeah.
And if he beats Chad Dawson, he moves up there. And people talk about, well, who's going to replace Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao, because they're getting long in the tooth. They're not going to be around forever. Who's going to be the next guys to be that number one pound for pound? And you know what? It might just be Andre Ward. And if it's not Andre Ward, maybe it's another guy from the Bay Area, Nonito Donaire, who's a junior featherweight champ who came up all the way from lightweight to junior featherweight, and he's looking at going to featherweight. And there's a lot of dance partners for him there. So September 8th, I'm going to be in Oakland covering Ward, Dawson, and then 1 week later, I got to figure out: am I going to Chavez Martinez or am I going to Alvarez Lopez? I think I'm going to send one or two guys over to the Thomas and Mack Center, which is a venue I do not like to cover a fight. It's kind of crazy. It's not organized well for boxing. I think I'm probably going to be ringside at the MGM Grand for Alvarez Lopez. I actually think Lopez is going to make it an entertaining fight. And the undercard Golden Boy has put together for Alvarez Lopez is really good. There's a really good featherweight fight between two Mexican champions, Daniel Ponce de Leon and Johnny Gonzalez. And that it might be like a fight of the year type fight. It might actually outshine the main event. But there's a real good undercard for Alvarez Lopez. So I'll probably be there. No matter what, I will be in Las Vegas September 15th.
Well, Doug, we'd love to have you on before that fight, and we want to thank you for spending time with us here at The Real Sports Guys, bringing to our listeners what we've always known about boxing and what it's all about. And we'd love to have you back on again before one of those two fights to talk about that, okay?
Thanks for having me on. I'm sorry if I rambled a little bit. I'll settle down. I'm kind of like Amir Khan right now. I'm just letting my hands go, proverbially speaking. And thanks for the patience with the girls interrupting me. You know,
no, we just want you to stick and move. Yeah,
okay,
just stick and move.
Right.
Just stick and move. We all right.
I'll stick to the game plan a little bit better next time.
All right. Well, you take care. Have a good night.
You're listening to The Real Sports Guys. RealSportsGuys.com, brought to you by Resistance Digital Solutions.
LL Cool J is hard as hell. Battle anybody, I don't care. You tell. I excel. They all fail. Gonna cut them double.
You're listening to The Real Sports Guys, RealSportsGuys.com, brought to you by Resistance Digital Solutions.
All right. Well, I think that, you know, what's been good, and for people who've been listening to our show for a while, we've had this constant theme that we've been talking about for at least the past 2 months, kicking off with Alan Sack, who really talked about, we were talking about the state of college sports. And our guest tonight, who has been on ESPN's Outside the Lines and many great public shows, talking about this issue, I'm excited to have him on. He's the president of the National College Players Association. Has been very involved in some what I would say is potential landmark cases around this issue, and has been very vocal around kind of the rights of student athletes. And so we want to welcome to the RSG community Ramogi Huma, who is the president of the National College Players Association. Welcome to the show, Ramogi.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, I want to start because I don't think people really know kind of the story and how organization was started. So can you kind of walk us through that process and how you came to even start this movement?
Sure. Well, I'm a former UCLA football player, and actually this group I started while I was still playing football at UCLA. And a couple of things happened my freshman year to drive me down that path. First was I was actually a true freshman backing up an All-American linebacker, Donnie Edwards. He went on to play in the NFL for a long time.
Yeah.
Donnie was a senior, and that year, my first year, he was on a radio show similar to this talking about how fortunate he was to be on scholarship, but the fact that his scholarship didn't quite cover the basic necessities, and that that particular month he had run out of food and didn't have any money and didn't know what he was going to do about groceries. So after the show, he goes back to his apartment and finds a couple bags of groceries on his doorstep. And, he was surprised, said a little prayer, took the groceries in, and somehow the NCAA found out and suspended him. And,
wow.
You know, we were pretty frustrated in the locker room when we heard that had happened. And we understand, most players understand what the NCAA is trying to do with his rules, but at the same time, you know, Johnny was suspended. They're selling his jersey in stores across the nation, number 23, you know, and all of us could relate. You know, matter of fact, by the time Donnie had been suspended, I myself had lost 15 pounds because I went from eating 5-6 meals a day in high school to 3 meals a day in college with a meal card. But, you know, for most students, that's good enough. But when you're burning thousands of calories on the football field, it's not. And, you know, it did get down to the basics, and it was a day-to-day struggle. That kind of just came and went. You know, we felt like, you know, we didn't have a voice. UCLA said, look, we give you guys everything we can under NCAA rules, but we can't change NCAA rules by ourselves. And, you know, again, it came and went. And then later on that year, going into summer workouts, we actually had a new coach, and we had an orientation about summer workouts. And this was the time of year they call it voluntary workouts, but they make pretty clear that it's pretty much mandatory. You know, and for the most part, players want to go get better anyways, but it's pretty clear that you got to go. Now, at the time under NCAA rules, our compliance officer stood up in the middle of orientation and said, look, if you guys get injured during these workouts, the NCAA will not allow us to pay for any of your medical expenses. You're on your own.
Wow.
And, you know, I wasn't too far removed from the recruiting process at that time. And, you know, I asked every school that offered me a scholarship, I said, well, what if I get injured? Who's going to pay for the medical expenses? They all said they would. And come to find out, the NCAA won't even allow a school, if it wanted to, pay for medical expenses. It would have been punished. And
wow.
That was the point in time where I felt like players just needed a voice, and I started talking to some of my teammates about it. I had some friends in my high school that had gone on and played for other teams as well, and everybody was saying the same thing. So that following offseason, I started a student group. It was pretty easy at the time. It was just three people with a mission statement at UCLA can start a student group, and that's what we did.
Right.
And that developed, and now we're a nonprofit advocacy group, and we have 17,000 former and current Division I athletes from all sports, and we're the only advocacy group out there, the only voice for college athletes.
The Knight Foundation's 2009 report. Can you talk a little bit about the findings and what that's meaning to the work that you're doing?
Sure. I mean, when you talk about reform and changing the system, towards the top of the list, you're gonna look at the Knight Foundation and the Knight Commission, and it's a body of current and former reformists that are, you know, athletic directors, college presidents, current and former coaches and administrators. And they every 10 years or so, they have really big reports. And in 2009, they released a report talking about how tough it was to get reform done. And they actually interviewed almost all of the FBS college presidents, the top college presidents in the nation. And all of them said, yes, we need reform. And almost all of them said they were powerless to bring forth reform, and they didn't know who could bring forth reform. And that was definitely telling. It backed up everything we've been saying, that the NCAA is incapable of reforming itself, because after all, the NCAA rules are actually adopted and put in place by college presidents. And if this very group is saying it doesn't have the power to reform, then who does? And
that's
for
right.
us, we've been saying, look, reform is going to come from outside pressure, from public pressure, from new laws and from the courts. And that's where we've been focusing our energy. So I think that was it definitely tells the tale in terms of where reform will come from.
One of the things that that President Emeritus kind of sent out and allowed for conferences to do is to look at kind of cost of attendance. And so this is something that, if someone who has been a college administrator, someone who's been involved in kind of the admissions and financial aid process, this is something that all students get consideration for. And I think that's something that most people who are in the media or people who talk about it don't acknowledge that. That
right.
cost of attendance is something we use for all colleges. So what's been the big reaction to that? Because I thought that was at least the first step. What's your feeling about that, at least that first move?
Well, and first, just to clarify for your audience, I mean, the cost of attendance is the price tag of the school. And the
yeah.
NCAA caps a so-called full scholarship below the price tag of a school. And
that's
the last
right.
several years, we've been actually doing studies showing that there's a gap between about $3,000 to $5,000 per player per year that they have to pay out of pocket expenses. Recently in the fall, the NCAA adopted, or the board anyways, adopted an optional $2,000 stipend to help try to close the gap, which we thought was definitely a step in the right direction. Not enough, but a step in the right direction. Since then, the schools rose up to fight it, and it looks like they're in the process of watering it down to the point where it's not going to have much of an impact at all. Not only will it be optional, if it's approved at all, the players are going to have to jump through hoops and try to prove that they need it. Our argument is that the numbers themselves show that they need it. You know, the calculations, the scholarship falls short of the price tag of the school. That equals needs. And these guys are generating billions of dollars per year, and the schools are dragging their feet and, holding on to every last penny, despite how hard it is. You know, I mean, from Donnie Edwards, my story from Donnie Edwards when I was starting out, you know, now we have in the media recent stories about something similar. You know, we have Jamar Samuels at Kansas State, who recently was about to finish his last game, walked out to in the men's basketball tournament, but they snatched him up because he had accepted $200 when he needed food as well. And yes, we understand, and we're not condoning breaking NCAA rules, but we're saying that the system is the culprit. You're going to guarantee scandals. This is going to happen all the time. The stipend would go a ways. Look, the kid didn't take $2,000. He took $200. You know, it didn't seem like it was all that egregious, you know, relative to some of the other stories. And you know, as of right now, the story is that it was actually for some basic necessities. But you know, the system turns players who are otherwise worth six figures. You know, we actually did a study with Drexel University. Hundreds of thousands of dollars these players are worth if they're in a fair market, but the NCAA unfairly gets the schools together, and they cap what the players can get, not even to a subsistence level, but below subsistence, below the cost of attendance. And actually, 85% of Division I athletes live below the federal poverty line by about $2,000 per year. So it's important to keep that in mind when we watch the schools drag their feet and fight an optional $2,000 stipend increase.
Yeah, and I think for people to understand, this is how any student who comes to a college gets that. If your student has a financial aid or an admissions presentation, they'll talk about the cost of attendance, which is books, pizza, and they'll say that's how we build your budget for financial aid. And so what we're talking about is just honoring what we say we do for every college student that comes to a university. So I think these are very important points to talk about. We had this, we've been talking about on our show, and I know you've talked about new revenue and how, and I want to get to some of the things that you talked about, but can you talk a little bit about, you know, what's happening with all this conference realignment and the idea that it's creating all this new revenue and, you know, what that means? Because I think people don't understand the context of, I mean, even when people talk about, you know, the educational value, people talk about not having playoffs, all these different things, but yet we have someone like Boise State who is having student athletes fly to the Big East to play football games, you know, every Saturday, when it doesn't make sense for athletes to do that. Can you talk about what this realignment has really kind of thrown into the situation as you're talking about opportunities to rectify this problem?
Sure. I mean, I think the conference realignment, there's been nothing that has made the NCAA's priorities more clear than the conference realignments and that of their schools. It's a money grab. You know, they're breaking traditional rivalries. They're forcing their players to spend more and more hours on airplanes and buses instead of in study halls in the classroom. And they're doing it for money. And where does this money go? How's it spent? Well, coincidentally or not coincidentally, it goes right back to the school and the coaches and the ADs. We have ADs right now making up to $2 million a year. Vanderbilt, their AD makes $2 million a year. And you wonder why they're willing to put these players on planes and sacrifice their education for more and more money. Now, what do players get in return? Nothing. You know, this is something for the ADs, fund money for the ADs and the coaches and the boosters, building luxury boxes in the stadiums and things like that. But, you know, when you're talking about basic necessities, health coverage and stipends and graduation rates, I mean, this is not going to help graduation rates. And if this is about education, then why would Boise State, why would San Diego State join a conference called the Big East when they're all the way out west? You know, this is, like I said, I think it's definitely showing their true colors and the fact that this is, you know, big business. And, you know, I think the NCAA has been given a lot of leeway over the years when they want to call it educational and avoid taxes and avoid paying their players. They call it educational. When they want to go ahead and break up and realign into a conference that will make more money, they say this is a business. So I don't think they can have it both ways. I think the new money that's generated should go towards at least some of it, not all of it, just a portion should go towards basic necessities and bolstering graduation rates instead of ripping them up and ripping up protections and forcing players to sacrifice their educational opportunities even that much more.
One of the things, in the Atlantic, you published a three-part plan to increase student-athlete compensation. Can you talk a little bit about that plan?
Sure. And I was asked the question whether or not players should get more compensation or not, or, you know, and if so, in what form. You know, it was kind of a narrow, I mean, there's a lot of issues, but in terms of compensation, definitely feel that a full scholarship should equal the cost of attendance, you know, just like an academic scholarship. The players are the ones who are generating all the money, and they're out there working hard. It's very hard to justify paying the coach, you know, $1, $2, $3, $4, $5 million a year, and then try to turn around and say, well, we don't have enough for your basic living necessities. So that's the first step. It would cost roughly, if you looked at the headcount sports for full scholarships, you're talking about men's football and basketball, it would cost a little less than $50 million a year. It's not a small chunk, but relative to the income that's being generated, especially the new income, it's definitely affordable. If you were to double that and give it to female athletes and headcount sports for Title IX, you come up with about less than $100 million a year. We did a study with Drexel University showing that there's almost $800 million per year in brand new revenue coming in just from the five of the big conferences and the NCAA alone. You know, there's tons of new money right now, and that would definitely be appropriate use of it. We also advocate creating an educational lockbox for continuing education. You know, if this is about education, shouldn't the NCAA and the schools be expected to invest in education with some of these new monies? You know, especially because they're getting a tax exemption. They're not paying taxes on TV revenue. They're not paying taxes on ticket sales. Our nonprofit, the NCPA, if we were to go out and run a Moneyball tournament, we get taxed as unrelated business income. But the NCAA has been given that grace. They don't have to do that. But at the very least, they should be expected to invest in education. Why should a player who doesn't graduate after 4 or 5 years, maybe with a semester left or a year left, why should the school kick him to the curb? Why shouldn't the school open its doors and continue supporting that player until they actually achieve their degree, they earn their degree? So that's another part. And finally, I think that it's definitely hypocritical. I mentioned my teammate Donnie Edwards. They're selling his jersey in the store. He's not seeing one dime and struggling for groceries. I think if they're going to use players' images, if they're going to, you know, use players commercially to make use their games to make big TV contracts and get paid, then players should have some access to the commercial free market. And by that, I'm not saying professional salaries, but I'm saying allowing players to go ahead and do some endorsements or getting a little bit of money for the jerseys their jerseys being sold in the stores. It does not turn a player professional, you know, to capitalize on their fame. And I think kind of what I've been saying is with Reggie Bush, you know, and people have a lot of strong opinions about everything that went down, but you know, I personally, and I'm a UCLA guy. I, you know, I wasn't crying too many tears when USC got busted. You know, as a alum, as a player's rights advocate, you know, I was concerned. But as an alum, I wasn't feeling too much. But I still, looking back, man, especially in the position I'm in, I feel like I would have much rather seen Reggie Bush doing a Subway commercial than giving back the Heisman Trophy. And that's what it comes down to, because the NCAA is trying to enforce the unenforceable, to legislate the unlegislatable. I mean, they can't legislate everything. You can't legislate weather, and you can't prevent highly valuable players from accepting money, especially when you keep them below the federal poverty line. So, you know, we're looking at ways to try to ease some of those pressures and come up with some of the solutions, not just to provide base protections, but also to root out some of the issues that are plaguing NCAA sports, like the scandals and like poor graduation rates.
You talk a lot about it. In, you know, my background, I work in higher education and value, you know, and have been a supporter of student athletics. I think there's so much that, and I think you would appreciate that, we learn from athletic experiences in terms of things that are transferable to life skills. One of the things I've been most concerned about is the inability, particularly of players in major revenue sports, to be engaged in the academic process. Is it possible? I know you talked a little about the educational lockbox, but one of the things that have you talked a little bit about rethinking the scholarships right now? And Dr. Sack talked about this a lot. I know Alan is a good friend and colleague of yours. Talked about when things change in terms of going to these non-renewable scholarships. Can you talk about, because I think that's an important thing to talk to about a student about. Way back in the day, it was like you had a four-year scholarship, and it wasn't year-to-year. Have you talked a little bit about that? Do you see that going back? What do you think about that in terms of providing that security for players?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. We actually won a pretty big victory. That's one of the things we've been fighting for the last 10 years. And you're right. Before 1973, when from 1950 to 1973, when they implemented scholarships, initially they were guaranteed for 4 years. The coaches lobbied hard against it. They wanted more control over their players. So the NCAA agreed to turn those four-year guaranteed scholarships into one-year revocable scholarships. And that's what it's been like since 1973. Now, most players don't understand that because coaches have not changed their recruiting pitch. They're still promising 4 years. They've still been promising 4 or 5 years. But the truth is that they're one-year revocable scholarships. And by that, I mean at the end of the year, a coach can refuse to renew a scholarship for any reason. We've seen players with 3.5 GPAs doing everything that they could do on the field lose their scholarships either because of an injury or a new coach comes in. They say that, you know, the player doesn't fit in their system. But they really don't need a reason. By NCAA rules, you do not have to have a reason. They just have to give you notice by June 1, and July 1, and that's how it's been. Recently, the NCAA passed a rule. Actually, when they initially approved the $2,000 stipend in the fall, they also approved an optional multi-year scholarship. So schools were able to give up to 4 and 5 years if they wanted to. But the minimum was still 1 year, and actually the schools rose up against that as well. They actually took that one to a vote, and a couple weeks ago, the new rule was upheld by 2 votes. I mean, hundreds of schools voted, and by two votes it survived. Just to go to show where the heart of the membership is, that half of them didn't want it, even though they weren't forced to provide 4 year scholarships. It's all optional. You know, any school right now, although the rules survived, but if a school wants to provide just a one-year scholarship, they're free to do that. If another school wants to do 2, 3, 4 years, 5 years, that's up to them. But half the membership didn't want it. But it did survive. So I think that that's definitely a good step in the right direction. There are some other issues surrounding that, because for a player who's only on 1 year or 2 year scholarship, 3 year scholarships, it's still up for renewal. They can still get rid of you for any reason. So if your school is not participating in that provision, then you might be in some trouble. And we get calls every July from players who had no idea that it could even happen in the first place. Say, how can they take my scholarship if I did everything right? But I think in terms of educational priorities, again, tax breaks, they're tax exempt for their educational mission, yet players could get fired at a drop of a hat, regardless of their academic performance. And a player who is in good standing can lose their scholarship, while a player who is academically ineligible might have their scholarship renewed. It has nothing to do with academics. It's business. And that's the reality of NCAA sports.
You're listening to Real Sports Guys. We're with Ramogi Huma, president of the National College Players Association, advocates for student-athlete rights. We definitely enjoy having you here. I want to let the game changer ask a question here. Marcus, I'll let you ask a quick question before we let Ramogi go.
I want you to touch on for a moment, you know, I'm of the video game generation, and I've grown up playing NCAA from back in the days in the early 90s with Bill Walsh college football, playing college football games, playing college basketball games where, you know, there's a guy with a Florida jersey on who happens to be wearing number 5. He has dreads, and he's 5'10 and 187 pounds. But that's supposedly, you know, that's number 5 from Florida. That's not the actual kid.
Right.
How does the whole video game piece using the likeness of college athletes play into your mission and what your organization is working towards as far as helping college players be able to have a voice in the use of their likeness and use of their abilities to make money?
That's a great question, and I mean it's ridiculous, you know, for EA Sports and the NCAA to try to stand up and publicly pretend that those are not the exact players on those rosters. I mean, it's ridiculous. Players know it is. I know everybody knows it. That's a big reason why the fans buy the game, you know. And players don't have any problem, you know, with those entities doing that. But the problem is first of all, they're forced to give up their publicity rights to their schools. There's no option. You know, Taylor Branch, you guys might have, I think you guys have referred to him before. He wrote an article called The Cartel, an e-book, a big piece in the Atlantic, and that's the power of a cartel. If you don't sign away your publicity rights, where do you go? You're not going to play NCAA sports. So these players basically had their publicity rights stolen, you know, and they had two choices, either don't play at all or give up your publicity rights for free. And in turn, we're seeing what the schools have done with that. Supposedly, the schools are there to protect them, and the NCAA, in their words, they protect them from forces of commercialization, and they don't want players to be exploited. Well, then they turn around and exploited players by doing the same thing they said they were going to protect them from. You know, players, if the players are going to be used, they deserve a cut, period, just like any other American citizen. No American citizen should have their publicity rights stolen and used without compensation, and players are the only group in America where that's happening to. So we're looking forward to the conclusion of that Ed O'Bannon case. Ed O'Bannon from UCLA, proud of him, UCLA alum, going after the NCAA sports for doing that, and he could change it for every athlete in the nation.
Well, that's
right.
Ramogi Huma, the president of the National College Players Association. Ramogi, we enjoy having you here. Hopefully you'll come back and be
anytime.
A part of this. We'd love to talk to you more about it, and thank you for being.
All right, thanks for having me.
Game changer, going back to you.
All right, again, thanks again to Ramogi Huma for joining us this week. Greatly appreciate it. Tons of insight. You know, it's an issue that is close to our hearts. You know, I played at NCAA Sports, not Division I. Devon played NCAA Sports, not Division I. And PhD played NCAA Sports, although not Division I. But at the same time, given that we weren't under the demands of a traditional D1 athlete, a big-time NCAA revenue-generating sport athlete, we had a different experience as student athletes. And I think our experiences are more in line with what everybody thinks of when they talk about being a true student athlete. And because of that, we have a different perspective on what Division I student athletes are missing by not being able to truly develop as people, develop as individuals. I have siblings who were Division I athletes. Devon has, you know, knows tons of people who, from his community, his neighborhood, who are Division I athletes. Same with PhD. And for us, this is an issue that always hits close to home because it is, you know, athletics is something that you only get to do for a certain amount of time. And to see entities, colleges making tons of money off of these young men, and them being penalized for trying to benefit from it, to me is a bit of a contradictory dynamic given the educational mission of most institutions.
You know, what you can also sense from Ramogi, what people miss the fact that folks are still fans. you know, Alan Sack, Ramogi, these folks are still fans of sports. They're still there, but they're fighting for rights. And so I don't want people confused that folks are not fans because they're questioning the system. These are still folks who love the game, and that's why they're questioning.
You listen to The Real Sports Guys, where real guys talk real sports. Sponsored by Resistance Digital Solutions, resistancedigital.com, RSG.
Now you can look the word up again and again, but the dictionary doesn't know the meaning of friend. And if you ask me, you know I couldn't be much help, because a friend's somebody you judge for yourself. Some are okay and they treat you real cool, and some mistake your kindness for being a fool. We like to be with some because they're funny. Others come around when they need some money. Some you grew up with around the way, and you're still real close to this very day. Homeboys through the summer, winter, spring, and fall. And then there's some we wish we never knew at all. And this list goes on again and again. But these are the people that we call friends. Together, we barely knew each other. We had no intentions on becoming lovers, but in no time at all, you became my girl. Me and you, one-on-one against the world. Talking on the telephone for hours at a time, and else I was at your house, or you was at mine. And then came the arguments and all kinds of problems. Besides making love, we had nothing in common. It could have lasted longer, cause it started out strong, but I guess we went about the whole thing wrong. Cause out of nowhere, it just came to an end, because we became lovers before we were friends.
Friends, how many of us have them? Friends, ones we can depend on. Friends, how many of us have them? Friends, before we go any further, let's be friends.
You say you and your girlfriend were so tight. You took her out with you and your guy one night. She even had a set of keys to your home, and you shared most of everything you own. But as she shook your hand, she stole your man, and it was done so sweet, it had to be a plan. Couldn't trust her with cheese, let alone your keys. With friends like that, you don't need enemies. You wonder how long it was all going on, and you're still not sure if your lady is gone. You say, well, if she took him, he was never mine. But deep inside, you know that's just another lie. And now you're kind of cold towards people you meet, cause of something that was done to you by some creep. But nevertheless, I'll say it again, that these are the people that we call friends.
Friends, how many of us have them? Friends, before we go any further, let's be friends.
You listen to The Real Sports Guys, where real guys talk real sports. Sponsored by Resistance Digital Solutions, resistancedigital.com, RSG.
All right, all right.
If you can dig it, let it forever be dug. You are now listening to the Real Sports Guys, where real guys talk real sports, also known as RSG Renegade Radio. I am your host, one-third of the illustrious three-man booth, Marcus Game Changer. I'm going to give you a quick rundown, and then I'm going to introduce the rest of the squad. Tonight, we got a heavy show, huge show, big show for the RSG crew. We've been talking about taking it to the next level, and we've done that tonight. Coming on early in the show, we have Coach Brett Bielema of the Wisconsin Badgers football program. He will be joining us tonight. We also have several coaches from the NCAA tourney lined up. We have Montana, who will be playing number 4 Wisconsin. They're number 13 seed in the NCAA tournament. Assistant coach Bill Evans will be joining us tonight. We have UNC Asheville, who will be going against the Syracuse Orangemen, or the Orange, as they're now known. Eddie Beidenbach, he'll be joining us. We have Ray McCallum from the University of Detroit Mercy, along with Doug Anderson, a Detroit Mercy player, who will also be joining us. We have South Dakota State assistant coach Rob Klinkapis joining us. And then we also have VCU, who will be playing Wichita State in the battle of two powerhouse mid-majors. This first weekend of the tourney, their assistant coach, Mike Rose, will be joining us. So we have all that lined up for you tonight. So stay tuned. Get on with the Real Sports Guys. Sit back, relax, and get prepped for the tourney. This March is mad, and we're bringing the funk. All right? So we're going to keep it real tight. We're going to keep it real, real workmanlike around here tonight. We're going to get in everything. But again, before we do that, I have to introduce the other two-thirds of the illustrious three-man booth. My man. My left-hand man, right-hand man, CLT, Sports PhD, what it do, man?
Christmas has come early in March. Fellas, I have some provocative NCAA picks. Y'all going to be trying to throw stones at me, but I got facts to back them up.
Okay.
You got facts, huh?
Uh-oh.
You got facts.
You got facts.
You know, this is what I think about your facts.
I don't have facts to back this up.
Don't get caught up now. Don't promise facts. Don't promise facts. It's 2012. We will fact check. All right? We will fact check. Okay? The other member of the illustrious three-man booth, I have the man, D. Will, holla at the people.
Man, you know I've been waiting for tonight for a long time. Excited to have Coach on, Coach Bielema. I think he is one of the most exciting coaches in the country in terms of what he's able to do with his program. And then the interviews that we have tonight, getting us ready for the tournament that's already kicked off. Is kicking off and all the excitement. I'm excited about that. We even have, you know, the Division II number one team we're going to be talking to later on tonight as well. So this is going to be heavy show. And you're going to be able to get these full interviews on realsportsguys.com. So we'll be posting those tomorrow. So you can get a feel for it. But, hey, when you think about our guest today, in his first six seasons, he has 60 wins, 6 bowl appearances, 5 times his team has been a final AP top 25. He has 2 Big Ten titles, 2 trips to the Rose Bowl. His career winning percentage is .759, is 4th best in the country amongst FBS coaches with at least 5 seasons of experience. In his first 18 games, he won 17 of 18 games, which is 2nd best start by head coach in Big Ten history. His team won the inaugural Big Ten football championship, defeating Michigan State Spartans 42-39 in a thriller in Indianapolis. So, hey, let's give a warm RSG welcome to head coach of the Wisconsin Badgers, Brett Bielema. How you doing, Brett?
I'm doing all right. Officially been married for 4 days, so it's kind of been a whirlwind, but it's good.
Ooh! Well, the thing about it is you joined the RSG, a few guys here who understand the value of marriage, and so we want to welcome you to the fold.
I appreciate it.
you know, Coach, before we get into, you know, I know you're going to be kicking off the spring game on the 28th, and I believe in April. Before we get in that, you know, you were 11-3 last year. You finished 10th in the final AP poll. As I said in the opening, you won the inaugural Big Ten championship game, but you were really two plays away from making a bid for a national championship game. You know, as you think about and kind of summarize the 2011 season for the Badgers, how have you been reflecting on that season?
Well, you know, really after the season is done, after that final bowl game and the game that you play in, obviously the last 2 years for us, the Rose Bowl, you really have a time there during January where you do a lot of, you know, recruiting, a lot of traveling. I believe I had 27 flights from January 3rd until the signing date, the 1st of February, and has a lot of time on the airplane to think about things. You know, I don't know if I've ever been in a season where there were the highest of the highs and the lowest of the lows as much as there was last year. I mean, obviously, I think back, you know, the first Big Ten game to welcome Nebraska into the Big Ten and for us to play the way we did and really handle them pretty well. And, you know, that night game in Camp Randall, we all know how special that is. Then take a bye week and come back and lose, you know, to Michigan State the way we did at the end of the game was gut-wrenching. To come back and play your tail off in Columbus, another night game, and to lose it the last minute like we did there was really a testing point, I think, for the chemistry of our entire program. You know, how the players are going to respond, how the coach is going to respond, and obviously respond very, very well. Put ourselves in a November that we needed to win every game, that put us in December to win another game against Michigan State to get an opportunity to go to the Rose Bowl, and it happened, and then obviously to lose a Rose Bowl, you know, as hard-fought a game as it was to such a good team. It just took a couple of weeks to get that out of your system, but our kids have been great coming back so far.
When I think about the season, you had two dynamic offensive players in Monty Ball and Russell Wilson. I mean, Monty Ball had, you know, 1,923 yards rushing, 33 touchdowns, Heisman finalist. Russell Wilson, 40 touchdowns, you know, 30 passing, 6 rushing, 1 receiving. You kind of, in this season, shattered this notion that Wisconsin football is 3 yards in a cloud of dust. Talk a little bit about those two players in this season and what that meant to have those two type of players on your squad.
Well, then I think first off, you know, the thing that both of them would tell you is they probably enjoyed the other one's success as much as anything. They really are really selfless kids that understand the value of chemistry and teamwork and working together. But I would say Monty Ball, you know, he's a guy that really going back to a year ago, January, I saw him restructure his body and you know, dedicate himself to the you know, the nutritional side and the training side as hard as any player I've ever seen, and really reap the reward because of it. I mean, just the way he's sculpted his body and got himself ready to play. And then the guy that added obviously a lot to our team this year, Russell Wilson, is just a you know, it's I know everybody's going to think it's coach speak or it's coaching cliche. As good a football player is, he's an even better person, an even better human being. Just great chemistry. Brought it to the locker room right away. The kids, you know, elect him captain 4 weeks later. He's so dynamic as a leader and as a guy that can really, you know, his two best quarters of football might have been the fourth quarter against Ohio State and Michigan State. I mean, he played and got us into those games, and all they ended up being losses. That was really, in my mind, stands out as some of his best football. So both great kids. I think you're going to hear about Russell next year in the NFL a lot earlier than most people think. And then Imani, when he gets this time a year from now, I think it'll be the exact same.
When you think about it, a lot of folks thought that Monty should have moved on to the NFL, and he's decided to stay. What was his decision making process? What happened? You know, how did you, I guess, talk to him, work with him through that decision making process? But what was it about for him coming back to play again?
Well, make no mistake, he was the best recruiting job of the year. I mean, doubt about that. He was on campus, but we wanted to make him stay. And you know what? I think the thing that I believe really came through to the forefront was just complete, honest approach to everything we did. I brought his parents in during the bye week, brought him in actually last spring for the first time and talked about, you know, the things that we could do for him to help get the best information out there. And then during our bye week, we sat down again and just kind of talked about, hey, this is where we're at. We'll fill out the NFL paperwork to get an early draft status. And then he really kind of set in his mind. I told him, you got to come up with a number. You know, what number will come back if you want to go, and what number comes back will you want to stay. And if it was a first rounder, I think he was gone for sure. You know, if it was a second round grade, he probably still would have been gone. And he came back as a strong third round grade, and he had kind of made a decision with his parents to stay if that was the case, and get his degree and finish his work here at Wisconsin before moving on. So I think just the whole approach was pretty smart by his process.
One of the things that I think that, and as we start to talk about the entering class of players, I was listening to a lot of conversation when they were talking about signing day and who had the top class, and they were interviewing the expert, and I remember someone saying, you know, we're not going to know what these players are going to do until about 3 or 4 years. We'll know what this class is all about. But we can't get so caught up in the rankings. And he used Wisconsin as an example of a program that has produced a number of players who have gone on to go in the NFL. I mean, Wisconsin players are all over the NFL. And really talked about, you know, the development of players. And that made me think a little bit about, you know, how do you approach, because I thought that was a compliment to a lot of the work that you and your staff are doing. How do you approach the recruiting class? And before we get into the players that you have coming in, you know, what are the kinds of things you look for when you're recruiting players?
Well, I think there's three critical things we try to evaluate. You know, obviously they got to be a good enough football player. There's somebody that we care about and think that they can help us win a championship. That should be pretty easy to see on film. You know, and I really don't care who's recruiting them. I don't care if they have 20 offers. I don't care if they have 2 offers or 0 offers. What we do is make our own evaluation off film, and we kind of have always looked for that underrated guy, maybe that guy that is just going to fit our type. And then the other two areas, obviously, besides the football skills, is, you know, academically, how do they check out? You know, to be here in Wisconsin, you have to be a certain type of student, not just to get admitted, but also to stay in school. You know, it doesn't do you any good for a kid to be here in year three. He's no longer around because he couldn't handle the academics. They're going to be their best players in years 3, 4, and 5, and you want them to be here. And then, you know, the third thing is just the social element. I really believe in a couple things. I always tell my coaches, hey, if you're recruiting this kid and you're wondering or not whether he's really kind of our type of kid, whether he can fit into Madison, just ask yourself, would you let him babysit your children in your own home for 2 nights when you weren't there? You know, it's a simple question, but it's easy for people to answer, you know, and I think that one part, we're never going to trade in an ounce of character to try and get a better football player. I think it's important for you to, you know, bring kids that you like to be around. So I'll go back to last year. This was a great stat. You know, this last season was my sixth year as a head coach. So it's, you know, my class, everybody in that room were guys that we've decided we wanted in there. I didn't inherit any of them. I brought them in, made the decisions. Well, the class before that was my first championship season, and it was my fifth year. So it was kids that, again, it was my first 5 whole years of being with them. Mm-hmm. And when the NFL signed, you know, first day of NFL camp, there were 14 rookies on NFL rosters that were from the University of Wisconsin.
Wow.
And it put that in perspective. The next highest class was Alabama. The next highest team was Alabama, had 8. So we had almost double the second highest total. And at first it alarmed me because I'm like, boy, that's a lot of players that aren't here. But it did show me, you know, hey, we went on to win another championship without them. But also that class, when they were as freshmen, they were rated 8th in the Big Ten. I believe they were like 60th in the country. And they had 14 guys in the NFL. It just made a huge statement to me. And this year I think we'll do the same. This year I would bet we have a minimum of 12 players that sign NFL contracts, might have as many as 16 of our seniors. So it's really a good time to take a step back and realize, hey, don't really buy into what's going on around you. Just go ahead and, you know, believe in what's in front of you. And our kids really do buy into that.
And you had a record 6 players playing the Senior Bowl, right?
Yeah, that was the highest ever. It was also, we had 23 All Big Ten academic All Big Ten players, which was the highest in school history. You know, I do believe there's a correlation to that stuff. And one of the best phone calls I got in January, second week of January, I was on a recruiting trip and I got a voicemail from our academic support staff, and we actually set a fall semester entire roster. My entire 120-man roster had set a school semester GPA record in the fall semester, which,
okay.
You know, I mean, that stuff, it all goes together, you know. I really believe that, you know. You just, and some of these kids, you know, don't come in, you know. I'm not saying every one of the kids is top 10% in his class, but if you get a kid, you know, that has got, you know, a decent academic background, and he shows great signs of being able to work for what he wants, you know, and then he gets into our support system, those kids just flourish because they see themselves having success, and it really makes a big difference. It gives them great confidence.
Now, you have 12 scholarship players coming in, and one of them, obviously, J.J. Watt's younger brother, amongst that crew. But talk a little bit about, and plus, and people don't know as well, as you place a lot of value also in your preferred walk-on, so some of these folks who are coming in as well. But talk about some highlights in this entering class of new
basketball. Well, we are, Derek was actually in last year's freshman class, so he's been on campus for a year. Look great about him. But in this latest class, we added an in-state prospect that we're very excited about, Vince Deagle, a kid from up in Wisconsin Rapids. His dad, Rocky Deagle, was an All-American at BYU and was a highly, highly recruited kid. And had him in camp the last couple summers. I think he'll be a perfect fit. We'll play him at linebacker and get excited to get him on campus. We signed three freshmen that are actually left school early January as seniors and are currently enrolled in second spring semester. Well, the first one, Dan Volk, lineman out of Chicago, who has been very impressive, weighs about 300 pounds and has developed really, really nicely for a high school kid coming in and fits in right away. And we also have a kid by the name of Avante Jackson, who's from Kenosha Bradford, a running back who unfortunately blew out his knee ACL the first game of his senior year, but has really done a nice job in rehab, and it should be able to go with us in the fall and see where he's at. And then we also had a young man, Hugs Adonai, from down in Boyd Anderson, or I'm sorry, Plantation, Florida, and has really been impressive through fall or through these first couple of weeks of winter drills. He's a corner who's very athletic, very gifted, and excited. So I would joke, it's kind of nice. We got two kids out of Florida. One was Hugs Adonai, and then we got a Reggie Love. Anytime you got a Love and a Hugs coming out of Florida, we're good. Reggie Love is a wide receiver that we're very excited about as well.
Now, you've made some inroads into Florida. And can you talk a little bit about how you've been able to kind of work state of Florida, you know, and get folks to come up in Wisconsin? I worked in admissions and recruiting, and sometimes getting, you know, kids from warm weather states looking at the state of Wisconsin is sometimes a challenge. So how have you really worked some of those and get some players out of Florida?
Well, the first thing is you have them visit in June and July. That's a very important element. You know, we don't bring them in December and January too often. But I think, again, it's like, what kind of kid are you looking for? For instance, you know, you take James White, who's, you know, a great player for us, comes from a private school, St. Thomas Aquinas. I brought in two of his roommates, Connor O'Neill, as well as Desmond Southward. Des is in the business school as a junior, and Connor is as well. And as you know, in working here in Wisconsin, that's not an easy thing to do. So, you know, two kids are already in there. But again, it's, you know, all of them come from, you know, two-parent homes. All of them come from, we do recruit a lot of the private schools, or we look for a certain type of kid that'll fit into our environment. I think that's very important. And I think the part that, you know, South Florida isn't really any different from recruiting a kid out of Jersey or recruiting a kid out of Ohio. You know, they're going to leave their home state, but, you know, you got to be smart about where you're going. For instance, in Florida alone, I learned this one being an assistant coach. I started recruiting to South Florida, you know, like Fort Lauderdale, Miami, and Palm Beach. So I said, well, this is going good. Why don't I expand a little further? So I went into Orlando for a couple of years, and I'd get in these recruiting battles, and you just couldn't beat, you know, the Carolina schools, the Georgia schools, as consistently as you could with a South Florida kid. Because a South Florida kid, I mean, he's down there now. He's going to have to travel 12, 14 hours to go to school in Georgia. Well, the Orlando kids only got to travel 6 or 7, and it does make a difference. There's almost like this little line across the state that kids will leave and go anywhere in the country, especially in the Big Ten, where they can get great exposure.
Okay. Coach, one of the things I wanted to hit before we let you go, one of the hardest things, I mean, you've done an incredible job, and we talked about what you accomplished in the first 6 years, but I think the most difficult thing you've done is to follow a legend like Barry Alvarez and to begin to develop your own brand and your own kind of legacy within the program. Talk a little bit about how that process has happened and how Coach Alvarez has also played a role in you establishing, you know, this as your program.
Absolutely. I think, you know, from my initial conversation with Coach Alvarez when we talked about this transition, he was very adamant about, you know, putting my own stamp or my own brand in the program. We talked about how there's definitely some things that work here at Wisconsin that should be kind of standard and move forward, and those were easy things for me to witness 2 years as an assistant, you know, just the brand of football, the way we have to prepare and train, what our advantages can be. You know, we may not be the most physically talented, but we definitely can be the most physically tough and mentally tough. I think that's a part that's carried through. And then as far as the transition, I believe my staff and my staff has been, you know, on a revolving process as well, you know, just with new faces, new people. But we stuck true to what Wisconsin really had been defined as, you know, hardworking, tough, don't beat yourselves, play smart, play physical, and you know, recruit a certain type of kid, a certain type of character that is never going to waver. So I know there's people from the outside world that think Wisconsin is, you know, the same thing it's always been, but it really is completely evolved into something I think competes on a national basis, you know, in a world of college football that really has changed, you know, over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years. So it's been a lot of fun. You know, one of our biggest fans and one of our biggest supporters is Coach Alvarez. I mean, obviously as an AD, to have a guy in that role that sat in your shoes and knows how difficult it can be is a truly huge advantage, and something that I'm blessed with as a head coach here on a daily basis.
Well, Coach, we do want to wish you well as you get into spring practice and into the spring season. And we'd love to invite you back as you get closer to the opening of the season. We certainly enjoyed having you on with us at The Real Sports Guys, and thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Appreciate the offer. Thank you very much. I'm Wisconsin.
All right. University of Wisconsin Badger head coach Brett Bielema. You know, that's what I'm talking about. This is someone who's been making noise nationally as it relates to college football. It's a program that has really established itself, you know, as a national power, and he's put together a really good team there. When you start to think about the lineage of coaches, Paul Chris, who's his former offensive coordinator, I believe, is at Pittsburgh. His former defensive coordinator is head coach at Northern Illinois University. And so this is only in 6 seasons that these folks are going on to getting head coaching positions. So excited about having him on. We're going to have a little bit of reaction going back and forth. Game changer. You had a chance to hear Coach Bielema talk. You know, you and I are very familiar with Wisconsin, the program. You know, I'd love to get your thoughts.
You know, it was really great to hear him talk about the recruiting philosophy of the program. Because, you know, as fans of the program, we all look at what the profile of every recruiting class that comes into Wisconsin. When you're looking at that, they're always like 60, 55, 50. They never have those glitz and glamour recruiting classes. But in the end, the coaching staff, Bielema and his guys, always get guys who, they always coach them up, they always get them to the league, they always get them to compete, which is an amazing thing because they never come in with that gravitas, with the big name. They don't come in like that. You know, they get kids who are good football players who they can develop, who fit into their system, and then they get them and they coach them up. And I think that's it was just really interesting for me to be able to hear him talk about what they look for when he talked about integrity and those kind of things, and what the profile of a Wisconsin recruit is. Because again, they're not the perennial 4-star, 5-star, national big name guys. They're not going to be guys you see playing in the Under Armour games or, you know, any other end of the season national all-star games. Who, you know, they're not signing day caps who you see on ESPN with the hats trying to pick a hat. These are guys that usually fly under the radar. They're good football players. They're quality football players. And Wisconsin figures out a way to get them in and make them better. And that was real interesting to see because, again, it's something that as a fan base we sometimes are concerned about because we see that and we're saying, well, we're not getting guys. We're not competing with the Alabamas and the TCUs and the Texases and the USCs. We're not getting those kind of guys. And so you know, we worry when we go up against those teams, but our guys usually hold their own. So, you know, hats off to Coach Bielema. And like I said, it was really interesting to hear him talk about that.
Well, you know, we're going to try and carry that thread going through. We're going to try and get some more coaches on to talk about that, because Game Changer, I think you hit right the point. I mean, getting into the psychology of a program in terms of how they approach players, I think it's very critical. It helps coach the fans and folks to understand that there's many different ways to build a national champion and or a competitive team that can be there every year. And to understand that, I think, is very important. Your analysis was right on point. I know we got the PhD back in the game. Phil, you had a chance to do it. I know you've been working a lot with setting this up with Coach Bielema. I'd love to get your reaction before we send it back to the Game Changer.
That was an excellent interview. And like Marcus, it was really helpful to hear some of the philosophies of the program, which helps explain, A, why they've been so successful, and B, you know, why they have produced so many players that fit in NFL type of systems. And one of the things he mentioned was that they're right up there, if not the top, in terms of producing NFL players, you know, that are successful in the league and make it into the league. And I think it comes back to a focus on character and finding guys who fit certain niches, who do certain things good. So it was really impressive to hear that. First-class guy, Coach Bielema. I've had a chance to interact with him throughout this process. So, again, it was just outstanding to hear thoughts in terms of the program, Russell Wilson, and the direction they're taking to move forward.